Getting Our Hands Dirty, the Future of Agriculture and Soil Management. This is the third forum in the 2012 forum series hosted by the Fenner School of Environment and Society at the Australian National University. This forum took place on the 29th of May 2012.
Thanks everyone. I'm Steve Dovers, the director of the Fenner School. I'm just going to quickly welcome and then pass over to the people who actually know what they're talking about. Although a lot of people know me as a social scientist, I should say my first post-school qualification was a certificate in agronomy. You didn't know that, did you? But thank you all for attending, and thank you particularly to the people who are going to contribute to the panel and hopefully lead a very good discussion. And in welcoming you to the Fenner School and to ANU, also acknowledge Australia's First Peoples on whose lands we meet here today, and pay respects to their elders past and present. This is a part of a series, I think we're at the midway point now, of what we're calling the Fenner Forum, which essentially is prompted to engender a discussion about, in 10 or 20 or 30 years' time, managing the Australian landscape. What sort of skills, what sort of knowledge will we need? And are we actually looking forward in that sense? So we are working across a number of sectors of forests today, soils and agriculture. The next one, which you'll all hear about, will be on biodiversity. And it's been very good so far, and I'm sure tonight will be as well. The format is my colleague Richard Green will introduce and set the scene and then introduce our panellists. We'll have time for discussion, and please come forward with your ideas. And then afterwards we will move next door, follow the crowd for drinks and catch up with everyone, and which is also where someone's business card will be pulled out of a hat and you win a nice prize. So if you don't come to drinks afterwards and network and your name's pulled out, well, I'm sorry, someone else will get the nice prize. But Richard Green, who's been the mastermind of this one from the Fenner School, is going to set the scene and will then manage our panel.
Good. Thanks very much, Steve. And I'd also like, on behalf of the Fenner School, to extend a warm welcome to you all. I've got the job tonight of chairing this meeting. I think it's incredibly important from a whole range of aspects. This topic is one that's not going to go away, and we've got a range of people here tonight to talk about it. I put up a slide which a lot of you would be familiar with, sort of issues we see in the Australian landscape, where after 200 years or so of our management, we've got major issues to do with the future of soils and land management. Continent. And this is what we want to discuss tonight, and how we can live with it and how we can improve it. We face a lot of challenges as professionals. We've got the issues, the new carbon farming that we've been told about. But are we headed in the right direction? Are we measuring it the right way? Are we measuring it the right level? Farmers are going to be paid on their farm. So we have to make sure that this whole initiative into carbon sequestration into the soil is being done correctly. We've got a problem that we're all familiar with. All our management issues are complicated by our variable changing climate. Our rainfall patterns are changing, our temperatures are changing. And this has implications for us in terms of how we manage it. We're continually told about food security for this country and for the world. How are we going to maintain our soils, our landscapes to provide this food? Everyone talks about food security. But what are the key issues? It's the soils, the water. We've disconnected a lot of our water. It's going straight out of the landscape. It's being lost out of the floodplains, and we need to reconnect it. We've changed a lot of the health of our soil. We need to improve that if we're going to maintain food security. We just heard the release of the Murray-Darling Basin Authority plan. Nobody's going to be completely happy about that, but it throws another challenge up to professionals, to farmers. Irrigated farmers have faced this problem for for the last couple of decades, they're being asked to maintain their yields, even grow more. Food security guys, but they're going to be given less water, so they're going to need our assistance. They're pretty smart already, but we can help them maintain their yields or increase them with less water. And there's farmers out there that are producing the same yields or more on 40-50% of their water allocation under irrigated agriculture, but we need to work with them. And then there's a whole range of other issues, and I've just put one up there, this issue of coal seam gas extraction. There's no shortage of challenges. What's happening as we drill down to get this coal seam gas? What are we doing to the groundwater, the connection between aquifers at the surface that may have relatively good quality water and saline aquifers at depth? So there's a whole range of issues, let alone should we be looking for coal seam gas on a lot of these prime agricultural lands. Have we as a nation got the resources to meet these challenges? Certainly, in the lifetime of a lot of people working here in the area of agriculture, soil management, we've seen shrinking government extension and research go into these issues. We need as a country, we need as a profession to be smarter about how we work on these issues. We're not going to get the resources as we did 30 or 40 years ago through the government. I believe we've got to conduct on-farm research directly with the innovative managers, farmers. Work with them and do this cooperative research that will solve a lot of these issues. They're doing it now already, and it's our role to work with them. And you'll hear about examples of that tonight where we've got the opportunity. And I believe FENA is taking a lead here in that a lot of our research is done on farms through memoranda of understanding with farmers, with research organisations. The whole structure of research is being modified, not being done by traditional government funding methods, mechanisms, and a couple of examples where the FENA School is working with the Malloon Institute and FarmLink. These are not-for-profit organisations. We've got the ideal opportunity to work with them and have our students out there solving some of these major problems. For example, a lot of you would have heard about natural sequence farming, the work of Peter Andrews. Peter is really instrumental in this whole issue of how do we reconnect our streams to the floodplains. And a lot of work on natural sequence farming is being tested at Malloon Institute and being looked at in other farms, other properties, to see how Peter's principles can be extended across different landscapes. We've got linkages with an organisation, FarmLink, which is an organisation that involves getting money from research organisations, R&D corporations, setting up the farm, the infrastructure, and then we've got the opportunity to work with organisations such as them, and we're currently starting on a major project to do with pasture cropping on the Tamora farm. I also see a key element in all this, putting it together, is the role of professional societies. And I take this opportunity to welcome members of the Agriculture Institute of Australia, the Soil Science Society of Australia. You guys have got an increasingly important role to train, to mentor the young professionals. And various leads have been taken by these organisations. For example, the New South Wales branch of the Soil Science Society currently writing a position paper to address some of the key challenges in soils in New South Wales. And then there's the opportunity for joint meetings between these organisations and research groups. And there's a meeting being held. The next meeting of the New South Wales branch of the Soil Science Society will be held on one of these research farms at Tamora on the 22nd and 23rd of June. I've got information about that. But there's this real opportunity to get our
act together with a lot of the people that have got the infrastructure. We can provide the researchers and the know-how and direct and link it directly to uptake by farmers. I'd like to introduce now the various members of the panel. I'm leading you through a structured discussion on these issues tonight. Firstly, Michelle Barson. Michelle's had extensive experience as a science advisor in the Department of Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry. Then Mike Burke. Mike's done a lot of consulting, research in the Asian Pacific region. Then David Marsh will be talking to us about his work as holistic farm manager in the Boorowa region. And then we've got an alumni member, Jo Singh, recent graduate from the Fenner School, who's going to be telling us about some of the issues that you face as a new graduate, how you get your first job, how she's found her training, the sorts of issues Steve was talking about, how well are we training our graduates to solve some of these major issues. So I'd like to now hand over to the first speaker, Michelle. Michelle did her studies at Melbourne University, and she's going to be talking about some of these issues related to research and development. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Richard, for the invitation and the introduction. I'd like to share with you this evening some of the findings of the recent stocktake for soils research, development and extension we undertook, and to have a look at some of the implications arising from the stocktake. And I'd also like to take this opportunity to report on progress with the sustainable agriculture component of caring for our country. The National Soils Agenda. It's a pretty big one, but for once it's actually a national agenda. Australia's soils are a major asset, but I don't think this has been widely recognised in the past. And thanks now to the carbon issue, they're actually on the national agenda. The key challenges that agriculture needs to meet all rely on our capacity to manage and manipulate our soils to improve their condition and their productivity in a more challenging climatic environment. Recent State of the Environment reporting and some of the Caring for Our Country work I'm going to tell you about tells us that some aspects of soil condition, particularly soil pH, urgently need attention. Australia will shortly make some major investment decisions for the long term in a number of areas related to soils, and it is important that we have the best possible evidence base for these decisions. I'm going to talk fairly briefly about some of the progress that we're making on the soils agenda at both the farm level and nationally in the R&D space, and suggest where there might be some major opportunities to make further improvements. First, I'll turn to caring for our country. This is Australia's major natural resource management initiative. The program over the period 2008-2013 in the sustainable practices area has had a very strong focus on soils issues because, as we all know, farmers manage 60% of the landscape and their land management decisions have a big impact both on farm and beyond the farm gate. Soil carbon and soil pH were two of the factors that we were seeking to encourage farmers to improve their practices about. These were identified by the National Land and Water Resources Audit as major driver variables affecting both water and nutrient availability, whilst wind and water erosion, the other two factors that are of particular interest, are major processes affecting how much topsoil is available for agriculture and the quality of that soil. We had some very good news in the budget. The government announced that it will commit more than $2 billion, to continue caring for our country for another 5 years. The sustainable agriculture stream is going to be managed in the Department of Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry, and around about $702 million will be available for this work in the next program, which starts after the next financial year. the new programs currently being mapped out for discussion with stakeholders, it's likely that it'll include a significant soils component because of the importance of soils to food security, agriculture's adaptation to climate change, and the need to maintain the provision of high-quality ecosystem services from agricultural lands. The first 5 years of caring for our country in the sustainable practices area, we invested around about $442 million, and there's a little bit more to come yet, for projects that would improve soil and biodiversity management practices on farm. To be able to demonstrate returns on investment of these funds, we've been monitoring on-farm practice change through the Australian Bureau of Statistics, which runs a special survey for us. And those of you who have to fill these out might have noticed a few years ago a whole lot of extra questions on the commodity survey. And there are some questions, not as many, of course, on the agricultural census. The commodity survey goes to about a quarter of Australia's farmers, so it's a pretty decent sample of what's going on in the agricultural landscape at the moment. We use practice change as a bit of a surrogate for reporting on soil condition because, as most of you know, some of the soil variables that we're interested in change fairly slowly, for example, carbon and pH, and monitoring them at intervals of less than 5 years is not at all practical or at all cost effective. I've got some of the reports we've recently released, industry reports at national and state level on practice change, going back in some cases to 1995. We're in the process of putting these together now for regions and states, but I encourage you to have a look at some of these, which are on the table to the side. I'd now like to turn to some of our other activities in the soils area. Most of you will know, ongoing improvements in agricultural productivity rely heavily on innovation through research, development, extension, and of course this includes soils RD&E. We put together a stock take to help build the business case for a cross-sectoral strategy for soils RD&E, which would have a look at what was going on in Australia and how we might actually improve what was being done at the moment. The stock take found that $124 million, roughly, was being spent on soils annually. That was a pretty significant amount. That's nearly as much as spent on grains research and development, which has probably one of the largest of the rural R&D expenditures. More than 53 organisations were involved in either doing the research or providing the funding. Don't know exactly how many because we didn't get responses from a few of the smaller universities. There are probably about 1,000 scientists, technicians and consultants involved in various aspects of soils RD&E. However, there was very little coordination of all this effort. And I'd like to share with you a couple of the more interesting findings. I think they're all interesting and I think it should be bedtime reading for all soil scientists, but you might need to read the executive summary to decide for yourself. One of the things that probably hadn't been quantified before, but many of you would have felt was the case, was that a very large proportion of the funding that's being spent on soils RD&E is currently being spent in tertiary institutions. And about 42% of the soils RD&E funding is spent in tertiary institutions, which is only very slightly less than the combined amount spent in state agencies. And I'd suggest that that's a significant change from, say, 15 or 20 years ago. On top of that, tertiary education institutions were contributing more than 10% of the total budget from their own funding, and I think that's a particularly interesting figure. Most universities indicated that funding for soils RD&E had increased over the last 5 to 10 years and that they expected this trend to continue. And a number of them were making significant investments in infrastructure, such as new soils laboratories and field stations at Sydney University. Most state and territory agencies in CSIRO reported little change or a decline, and most often a decline, in the resources that they were able to obtain for soils RD&E. Okay, better speed up. This was also something pretty interesting. We had a look at the age of soil scientists and found that there was nearly 20% of them were under 35, so not all of us are old and grey and ready to retire, so perhaps some hope for the future. One of the other things we found with the soils RD&E stocktake, and this is something of serious concern, is that while there are a whole lot of opportunities which we will start to explore for improving the effectiveness of investment, a big problem was the national soils data infrastructure. We really have some pretty significant problems with our soils information. And there's the stocktake had an appendix, a copy here, looking at how much soils data we don't have, both spatially explicit data and also soil profile data. And we really don't have the kinds of data that are needed to answer contemporary soils problems. And this is an issue we're going to focus on quite significantly into the future. DAF and CSIRO make a modest investment in trying to improve soils information through the Australian Collaborative Land Evaluation Program. Some of you will be familiar with the Australian Soil Information Database and the National Archive, but it's pretty modest investment. We need to do a lot more in that area. A couple of things that we're looking at the moment, we don't have the resources for these, but we'd be very keen to develop some programs that use some of the newer technologies to undertake digital soils mapping. These bring together things like high-resolution digital elevation models, airborne geophysical surveys, time series remote sensing, and rapid soil measurement using a range of new sensors, together with online delivery of spatial information. And we think that this is going to be one way of cost-effectively collecting quite a lot of soils information that is needed for the predictive modelling type of approaches that we're increasingly needed to use if we want to look at, for example, the likely impact of climate change on soils and crop production. We've been making some modest investments in this area, mainly in capacity building in state agencies, and running a pilot project in Tasmania looking at what is happening in irrigation areas and what information is needed. And the other area where we're hoping to make some investment is in long-term soil condition monitoring. Caring for Our Country's funded some monitoring of wind erosion, and we're hoping to fund some water erosion monitoring, but developing methods for this has been a bit problematic. However, we have managed to develop our national methodologies for monitoring carbon and soil pH. No funding yet, but we really are quite worried about the soil acidification problem. These data come from a colleague in Western Australia, Chris Gazy, and the numbers of farmers who are liming in Western Australia and elsewhere, we think are not as high as the number actually needed. This graph here, the pink bars show the estimated amount of agricultural lime that's actually needed to maintain pH at good production levels against the actual amounts of lime sold in Western Australia for a number of years. And you can see that there is a very big gap between these. Now, Western Australia probably is, the wheat belt is the area at highest risk of soil acidification with largely very sandy soils. But there are certainly areas in eastern Australia, including not too far away from here, that have a significant acidification risk. There's a bit more data on the extent of that risk that we currently understand in some of the brochures that I've provided you with. We're pretty keen to establish a national program to monitor soil pH, to set a baseline for monitoring change, to detect areas where the subsoil is at risk of acidification, and there are a number of areas within WA where we're already seeing subsoil acidification at 30 centimetres. and identifying areas where we need further intervention. I know people sitting in the front row and some other people who've been around for a long time will think that we've already made a huge effort to try and encourage the uptake of liming and so on, but I don't think we've been as successful as we might have hoped. And a monitoring program like this would provide some really good feedback to farmers and to others. Thank you very much for your attention. As you can see, we've got some major challenges ahead. At the moment, there's a high level of interest by ministers and stakeholders in soils issues, and it's a good time to be working together to improve soils RD&E. There are two members from universities on the committee that will be looking at developing the soils strategy: Alex McBratney from Sydney University, whom I'm sure many of you know, and Ian Young from UNE. So I'd really encourage you to approach them and talk about how tertiary institutions could contribute to addressing some of the issues we are going to hear about tonight. Thank you.
If you could save your questions up, we're going to have a panel question and answer session at the end, please. Now, I'll call on the next speaker, Mike Burke. Mike's had extensive experience in research and consultancy in the Asia-Pacific region. So over to you, Mike. Thanks.
Thanks, Richard. Thanks for the invitation this evening. What I want to do this evening is make a case for agriculture. Why agriculture? Why does it matter? I've been on a long journey. I'm a crop physiologist, but I'm actually going to talk about dead kids tonight. So it may not seem very well connected, but I spent 6 years of my life in Papua New Guinea describing agriculture. We got into income led into poverty. Poverty is a disputed concept in Papua New Guinea, so I've stopped talking about that. I'm talking about something more emotional. I don't need to convince an audience like this, perhaps, but certainly in Papua New Guinea, I need to convince people that it matters. But what I want to do right now is make that link. The other thing I want to do, though, is not so much talk now, but later on, certainly if anyone wants to, how do you get your time in the door? If you're interested in working overseas, how do you do that? So that's... Richard suggested I give a bit of background about myself. I've got formal training in agricultural science and crop physiology, and then I moved into human geography at the doctoral level. I spent 13 years working for the Papua New Guinea government, which is the last time anyone ever paid me a salary. So I've been self-employed. It's a funny career, or different career. So I work as a consultant, but in the process I have an adjunct, something professor or something here at ANU, which is a fancy way of saying I do a lot of work and I don't get any money. So that's why I'm still working for ExxonMobil and the Highlands of New Guinea on the PNG LNG project. But in between working for Exxon and many other clients with all the initials in the alphabet, I do academic work, I have students, and my most recent book is called Food and Agriculture in Papua New Guinea, but I've edited, I think, written six books and done it in the last decade and written a couple hundred papers.
That's boring. Enough of that.
A bit about Papua New Guinea. 7 million people. We used to say the same as New Zealand, then we used to say the same as Queensland. Well, now it's the same size as New South Wales and growing rapidly. But almost 6 million of those people are rural villagers. It is the most rural society on the planet, as distinct from Australia, which is one of the most urban, in fact.
So about 6 million people are rural villagers.
Here's a few images of agriculture. This is what agriculture looks like. That's sweet potato, the dominant food in the highlands. This image is about 1,800 metres. These are composted mounds, indigenous technology developed, I believe, about 120 years ago. That's fresh compost, which the ladies and the fellows have put in there, about to be covered. So you're looking at newly planted sweet potato, mature sweet potato, that's sugar cane, casuarina oligodon, it's not the same as the casuarina we get around here, the Cunninghamii, under which you've got a bit of coffee, and that's just a typical highland scene. I don't know what that stuff is. Some of you young people probably know that. I'm a bit of a bush fellow, so that's a cash crop, and a major cash crop, known as green gold in Australia. I've got a student of ours, he's about to submit betel nut trading routes. He's doing a PhD on trading betel nut, you can see it's a significant thing. It's not trivial. Mount Hagen market, he's calculated. I think it turns over, what is it now? It's 170 million kin, about $85 million in one market alone per annum. So it's more important than, say, coffee or even oil farm. That's agriculture in the export economy, as distinct from the domestic economy. You can see that in the purple there, the renewable resource sector, agriculture, forestry, fisheries, is about a quarter, and that's been stable for more than a decade. Within 3 or 4 years from now, that'll be down to 8% and falling. This LNG project that myself and others are working on is big. I mean, just one statistic alone, the airport being built in the jungle up there is longer than Canberra. 3,200 metres, Canberra's 2,800 metres. On it goes. The numbers are staggering. They're mind-boggling. Everything is big. $6,000 million US gross income per annum, and that's on two trains, that's processing unit. It's big. So where does agriculture fit in all of this? Well, my argument is it's really important because the bulk of the people depend on it.
Let's look at this another way.
Cash income. Cash matters. The most important way of getting money for the bulk of the population, who are rural villagers, is from agriculture. They're quite low, typically 500 Aussie a year to about 6,000 Aussie a year would be a big income. That's people with betel nut or oil palm, some of the more valuable crops, potatoes. A small number of people get more income from things trading, betel nut, transport, other services, but they really are a minority. Now, that money matters. It really does matter. You put your kids to school, and a woman's got a difficult birth, you can get her in a provincial hospital, you've probably got an 80, 90% chance of saving her. In the village, she's probably got a 30% chance of being alive at the end of a breached birth. On it goes with the kid's got malaria, a bloke that's fallen out of a coconut tree. Money matters. It makes a difference. We saw that most clearly in the 97-98 drought and frost, the worst drought and frost in recorded history, that is to say in 140 years. AusAid, the Australian government, the Australian Defence Force, claimed credit because they control the television, but they only actually provided 4% of the extra food that was bought, the additional rice. 82% of the rice came from mum and dad, ordinary people, in the urban areas where they bought it for their one-talks, their family at home, or the village people. And where the people died, and some place they died in big numbers, it didn't depend whether they ate sago or bananas or sweet potato, the colour of their skin or anything else. What mattered was that they were remote and poor. In some locations in the drought, up to 7% of the population. So the technical term is a crude death rate, 70 per thousand, but that was in less than a year. So in some places, 7% of the population died, and they died where they were poor. Cash also allows people to improve their diet. The two nutrients that are deficient in people's diet are fat or oil, what the nutritionists call concentrated forms of energy, and protein. If you've got a little bit of money, you can buy a bit of rubbish lamb flaps. You and I shouldn't eat it. It's not good for us. But if you have a little bit of that once a fortnight, once a week, and you're doing lots of exercise, it's not a bad thing.
Money matters.
Here's a typical sort of data set we have. This is from Fresh Produce Development Agency in six districts in Eastern Highlands. So this is the main source of cash income for 75 households, and as you can see here, it's mostly agriculture, fresh food, vegetables, coffee, other export crops, livestock. And that's the typical data. We get data sets like that from all over the country all the time. Most people get most of their money from agriculture. I want to talk about what this money means. Now, so I'm not going to talk about poverty. Let's talk about children who die. Where you have the lowest child mortality rate, child in this context means naught birth to 60 months. Where you have the lowest child mortality rates are the urban areas. There's only two cities in Papua New Guinea, and there's only six towns of any size. Urban areas or where there's a fair bit of agriculture, which generates money, whether for the domestic market, betel nut, marijuana, fresh food, firewood, or the export market, trees, essentially. Where you have the highest child mortality, the other thing I should say, it's a better physical environment. The rainfall is between 1,800 and 3,000 millimetres a year, not so steep, not so swampy. In places that have a crummy physical environment, which means over 3,500 millimetres a year, either swampy or very high in this context means above 2,300 metres, that's higher than Mount Kosciuszko, poor environments, no significant economic activity, that's where a lot of kids dead before they're five, before they're one. Where you have the major extractive industries, it's not much better than the worst places. Extractive industries means logs, raping the forest basically, not sustainable logging, oil, gas, copper, silver, gold.
A few figures on that then.
So here's a ranking of the districts. A district is an electorate, typically 50 to 80,000 people, with the lowest child mortality rates. Now you can see Port Moresby, second from the top there, is 27. So what that means is 2.7% of kids are dead before they're five. If you're not used to those sort of statistics, the figure for Australia is four. most of the Western countries, Singapore, it's 4. The poorest of the poor in Australia, who's Indigenous kids in the Northern Territory, the figure's about 14 or 15. So the worst of the worst in Australia is about 1.5% of kids are dead before they're 5. The best here is Port Moresby down the bottom of one district, Kundiawa, and it's a bit under 3%. So we can see it's 2% up to 5%. The major industry is either government, commerce, trade, in other words, it's urban, or it's coffee, fresh food, copra, it's agriculture. There's one exception there. South Bougainville has a bit of copper. It's cocoa, not that much.
So the best places have significant cash crop agriculture, as well as a very good subsistence food production.
The worst places, the Rye Coast, etc., Nuku, right through to Manyamia, where the death rate is between 12% of kids are dead before they're 5, through to horrendous 23, you see the major industry in every place, it's the same. They'll go something.
Zero.
There is no industry, no oil, no gas, but certainly no agriculture. If we look at the extractive industries, Coma Margarima, I've just come down there from 2 weeks ago. I flew into a place called Mimbarali, choppered in and left my camp about 6:30 in the morning, got a chopper. I was on the ground with 7 of my team members, 5 ladies and 2 fellows. We're on the ground by 8 a.m. We worked all morning with a group of people and we walked out 3 hours to a roadhead that afternoon. And I talked with the people there and they were saying we desperately need a road. We've lost 3 kids, community of 50 people, 3 kids have died since I was last there, which is about 15 months ago. So that's the reality on the ground. These are the numbers, but on the ground that's what's happening. 3 kids dead in a bit over a year. All these places, so where we have gas, logging, gold mining, very high figures, up to 13% of kids dead on the south coast of New Britain. Okay, a few concluding remarks. Most Papua New Guineans are rural villagers. The same applies to many, the entire Western Pacific, in fact. Agriculture continues to provide most of the food that people eat, 80% of the calories, in fact, most of the protein, most of the cash income. Production of food for sale on the domestic market or the export market is associated with various indices of disadvantage. I've talked about child death rate. It could be maternal death rate. It could be the number of females that have illiterate, whatever. These parameters are all highly correlated. One study by the World Bank used one parameter. Our own studies have used 5, another one used 35. We all come to the same conclusions. There's a great need for agricultural innovations given the high population growth. The population here is doubling every 30 years. Pressure on land. The climate is changing. Those of you who know Papua New Guinea will be surprised to know that the coconut's now bearing Goroka. And it blows me away when I see a coconut bearing it at 1,600 metres above sea level. When I lived in the highlands, they stopped at 1,200, so it's really moving. Rainfall's changing, rapid urbanisation and ongoing poverty. There was a role for Australians in this, Australian-based people. There's a role in development more broadly, not just in agriculture. And after this meeting, over a cup of tea or a beer, I'm happy to talk with anyone that wants to talk about how you might get your toe in the door. And I neglected to say, but Richard did ask me to mention that I'm representing the Institute of Ag Science tonight as well. Thanks, Richard.
Okay. Thanks, Mike. If you could hold your questions again. Thank you.
Now, it gives me a pleasure to introduce to you all David Marsh. David Marsh has had a long association with the Fenner School, over 20 years. We've been going out to his property at Borua and mapping it, doing experiments on it, and David's been a constant source of inspiration for our students, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce him tonight. Thanks, David.
Thank you very much. I'm going to tonight talk about a few of the big picture issues that confronting humanity, and then try and say a little bit, if I've got time, about what we're doing on our place that sort of fits in with the big picture, I think. We're just a farm family, or shouldn't say just, should I? That's a bad introduction. We're a farm family at Borua, and we used to talk about being livestock managers and cropping farmers, but now we've probably call ourselves managers of sunlight, plants and time. We're trying to make a profit out of plants and animals. We're trying to make produce time for recreation. We're trying to produce habitat for the things that we don't make money out of, because they're really fundamental to the land equation for its long-term functioning. The sort of landscape we live in and that we're proceeding towards with our decisions is a perennial complex grassy woodland, and we're sort of doing some monitoring to try and see whether we're actually proceeding towards that. So a couple of these big picture things, I want to contrast how the world functions as opposed to how agriculture functions. And the natural tendency for 3.5 billion years of life on Earth, as far as we know, is that the tendency is to elaborate and diversify the biota. And that everything we do as human beings is governed and underpinned by the process of photosynthesis. However, agriculture does almost the opposite to that. Human beings, human society since agriculture began has proceeded at the expense of natural capital. So we've been about simplifying the land community. So complex communities, ecosystems, they harvest sunlight, they produce their own food, but about a third of the energy that they gather from the sun is needed to maintain their structure and diversity. Now, agriculture tends to harvest that energy that the community needed for its ongoing function and stability. We've found more and more ways of harvesting the product of photosynthesis, shoveling it into our mouths and pockets. And the money that we make from doing that we call income, but in actual fact it's been a capital liquidation. And we all know that if we liquidate capital out of a business for very long, it'll be very different, or maybe not even exist. So the problem, I think one of the fundamental problems we have as society is the way we account for our behaviour. Because what we do is we account for it in terms of money, and we always ignore and defer the costs that our behaviour imposes on the ecosystem that ultimately makes our life possible. And we know that in Australia, in many areas, either grazing or cropping areas, that our activities have reduced soil organic carbon by up to 70%. So ecologically, we've been living beyond our means, and we haven't accounted for it. It's not on the national accounts, and it's not on the farm account. So we've got some wicked problems, and we're going to need some really different thinking to solve them. And we know what they all are. We've probably heard about them all already tonight. The human population is a really big one. Increasing cost of fossil fuels. There's a whole lot of paradoxes in here, because the population has been driven by surpluses of food produced by agriculture, which drives population growth, which then increases the amount of energy that we use. It's right through our society. We can't do without it. We're addicted to it, and society would collapse without it, and yet the supply is going to diminish and get more expensive over time, which is going to be a really difficult issue for us. Because of our simplification of the landscape through our activities of agriculture, biodiversity is under threat. There's lower per capita availability of water right across the world, been lowering since 1984. There's less land per head. 1900 there were 7.6 hectares, now there's, well, in 2005 there's a bit over 2 hectares. Lower food quality and the effects on human health is becoming an issue. We've got a paradox there. In some countries people are starving because they can't get enough nutrients, and in other countries people are dying because they're getting too many. And our own natural tendencies as human beings and how we address change is a really big issue. I can't talk about it here now, but if you want to ask me a question, I'd like to get into it. Some of these things increase the chance of uncontrollable disease, possibly. And the questions about the amount of energy that cities use and whether they can be sustained into the future. And also, because that thing about cities if there are land problems, they're actually city problems. They're whole of society problems, because the energy needed to sustain a city is fundamentally affecting what goes on out in the landscape with soils. And also some of the very high energy agricultural systems that we have, we're addicted to them, we love them, we get very excited by feedlots and big piggeries and chookeries and big irrigated dairies and all those things. But if we look at the amount of energy that some of those systems are using, we have to question whether they're going to be viable in the future. So, yeah, we've seen that. These sorts of things are only possible at when fuel prices are low. And that's out in the desert out in Western New South Wales. So it's all very well for Marsh to get up here and talk about all these problems and probably suggest that other people should be doing lots of things, but what was he doing in 1982? That's how poorly we were managing. And it's really... it's quite a big thing for a farmer to admit that although we cared about the landscape as much then as we do now, the decisions we made created that scene. So you can do a lot better, and we think we have done a lot better. That was a big wake-up call for us in 1982. So the sort of things we're trying to do now is to manage these four building blocks of the ecosystem: the water cycle, mineral cycle, energy flow and community dynamics. And that's the same scene as that drought scene in a fairly dry spring in 2004, so we have done a little bit better. But all around us, and this is a really fundamental problem that I don't know what the solution is, but as soon as it gets dry in Australia, farmers lack the confidence to make decisions that stop these sorts of scenes. This is our country in the foreground in a year when there's dust blowing right next door. Now, it's not that those people on that dust-ridden country don't care about their farm. They're very good farmers. But we seem to have fixed enterprises in a variable climate, and we value our businesses over what's going on in the landscape. And so we keep on making these awful scenes every time it gets dry. And then a month later, when this country's been blowing dust for a month, we get a storm, there's no cover on it, so most of the water runs off it. So it's a real catch-22 for those who are in that situation. And then it's blowing again. And, you know, the decisions we make dictate how the landscape looks. There's no truer saying than that as a farmer thinketh, so is he. And it's not that people that create the scene on the left have a view very often that when it gets dry, that's just what happens. But it happens because of what we do and what we think about. And, even during the drought, we tried very hard to have 100% ground cover, and I think we achieved it 99% of the time. We didn't feed any animals at all over 9 dry years. We achieved ground cover by removing animals rather than feeding them. That saved us between $500,000 and $800,000 over 9 years. So at times our income was quite low, but because we hadn't incurred those huge costs, there were several effects. A, there was the economic cost. B, there was the business cost, they're both economic, of course. The social cost, the human cost, was much less to us because we felt that our farm wasn't blowing away, we were being responsible, and that is a huge thing. We underestimate absolutely the effect of drought on human beings. So when you try and manage to let plants express themselves to their capacity, which is what we're trying to do all the time, moving animals around, letting the landscape recover between grazing, you end up with a lot of organic matter in your soils. Generally in our area, soil organic carbon 1% if you're lucky. We've got a number of tests that have sort of shown that we're getting up over 3%, approaching 4%. They're difficult figures to quote. Everyone gets the, it's inconsistent, etc. But what that's showing is that there's a large amount of organic matter in the soil that's holding onto water and allowing plants to be green for longer. That's really important. We use animals to recycle the nutrients in the system. We have long recovery periods, usually between 50 and about 200 days between grazings, and that allows the plant community to do what it naturally wants to do, which is grow, reproduce, and diversify. And that's what's happening. We're getting a lot more diversity in our paddocks. Some of our sown pastures from the past have only 7 or 8 species of plants in them. Where there's a lot of change happening, we're measuring up to over 50 species. They're not all species that everyone likes. Some of them are what we call weeds. But generally what we're finding is that the weed population, although we've done no spraying for 14 years, is actually less than it was when we sprayed weeds annually. However, you do have to get used to untidiness sometimes. We have an obsession with tidiness in farming, and we probably need to get away from that. But then all of a sudden you see something like these little fringe lilies come up, and that, as you drive past them, you get this intense smell of chocolate, and it's just, that's as good as a 30-bag wheat crop, and although it's not putting any money in the bank. We've had some summer rain over the last few years, and so we've been getting increase in summer species, summer perennial species. I had a little bit of a go at trying to put a value on what are these uncosted benefits from managing the way we do, or people like people that manage the way we are. And if I can just try and... Yes. We've changed the woody vegetation on our farm from about 3% up to about 15% over the years. So we said, we did a few calculations, and we, this was before they put a $23 carbon price on, roughly where the value of the carbon in the soil is about $12,000 a year. In the trees, it's roughly $28,000 a year. They're pretty rubbery figures, I'm sure. So, if you look at the avoided costs from the way we're managing now, we haven't used any inorganic fertilisers or chemicals for 14 years. That's an annual saving of about $55,000 plus an increase in the value of carbon, which we're not being paid for, but which is providing benefits anyway, of about 40. So, you know, it's significant value for changing the way you think and manage. Thank you, Richard. And there are lots of other important creatures that are hanging around on our farm as well. These are some Cunningham skinks. And of course, Boro is the home of the superb parrot. And I've seen one of these on our place, and I won't be happy if I die before I see a group of them. We've got a really big influx of raptors this year because of the mice that were very abundant last year. And lots of other things are happening. We're seeing lots of these fungi rings popping up. Now, fungi are a really, really important recycling mechanism in the landscape for recycling cellulose. They're the shock troops that start the process of breaking it down and releasing the nutrients back so that they can be reused again. And, this is the sort of landscape we live in. We're very fortunate to be living there. We hope that we're good stewards of the landscape. I guess one of the things that humans find difficult, I think, is that we're very, very good at making short-term decisions when we're really in a crisis. Because really that's our history. You know, since humans like us have been around, we've been making short-term decisions for our survival because, you know, for 90-odd percent, way over 90% of the time that people like us have existed, we didn't have agriculture. We had hunting and gathering and surviving from threats. So we're really good at short-term stuff, but we're really poor at long-term stuff. And everyone wants things to be good in the future, but nobody wants to make a sacrifice to get there. And we just have to make sacrifices if we want to have a world that's going to be okay for those that come behind us. And part of that is the way we account for what we do. And I don't know whether anyone's going to ever add the second and third parts of the triple bottom line, but at this stage we're still blundering along with economics, looking at money, and it's probably not good enough. Thank you very much.
Thanks, David. Again, could you keep your questions till the question and answer session? Call on the final speaker now, Joanna Singh, who's a recent alumni, graduated, we're proud of her, first class honours last year, and she's out there in the job force. So thanks, Joanna.
I don't have a nice presentation like everyone else, so I'm just going to give a brief introduction of what I studied in ANU. So I did soil science mostly with other courses such as groundwater from the geology department, and then there's GIS as well, which has been really helpful after I started my job at SMEC. Most of the time, I'm out sampling, so for contaminated sites, so buildings that have been demolished, and we're just testing whether the soil is contaminated, and if it is contaminated, then we'll have measures to either put them off-site, or if they're not contaminated, they can be used on-site, and probably new buildings can be built. Apart from that, we also do groundwater testing. So, like, recently I went to Pambula, and there was to check whether the underground service tanks contaminated the surrounding soils and surrounding water. So we carried out tests as well. And all these are translated into maps, so they can be used and passed on to other people to check. So I guess it has been really helpful studying soil science here, because it gave me a lot of practical experience going out to the field and under the sun and intense weather, and it's really helpful. And oh yeah, one of the more interesting part of my work was actually being out in Takada along the Hume Highway to actually monitor squirrel gliders and to see the impact of how the Hume Highway actually affected the population of the squirrel gliders on either side of the highway. And if we, as in, because the surveys actually showed that the road bridges that were built, certain species, or there were more species of squirrel gliders on the other side that were not found on the other side before the road bridge was built after the Hume Highway, if it makes sense. But that's about it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joan. And could I ask all the speakers to come back up the front now, sit on a stool? And this is your opportunity, as members of the audience, to ask questions.
Who'd like to lead off?
Thank you all very much for some interesting presentations and thoughts. I'd like to address this first to David, but the other may wish to add to it as well. And that is the means by which you acquired the knowledge to manage your farm, and how can one short-circuit what is obviously a fairly long-term knowledge-gaining process?
Thank you. I didn't have any tertiary education. When I left school, I went off jackarooing. I probably should have become a doctor like my father, but I had the bush in my blood and I wanted to pursue that. I was lucky enough to have a farm to come back to. And then I guess my parents were both very interested and interesting people. And I think that probably, I'm saying I'm interesting, but I was passionately interested in almost everything. And I've been on a long journey of trying to find more benign ways of behaving on the landscape so that it improves rather than goes the other way. So the big jump, I guess, for me came in 1989. I read a book by a guy called Alan Savory who put together the thinking on holistic management. And then at the end of the 1990s, I did a holistic management course at the same time as I was doing a master's degree in sustainable agriculture up at Orange at Sydney University. And the reading I did through that course and then the practical application of the holistic decision-making process, which takes into account the three sides of the land equation, people, business and landscape. The practical application of that probably led me to where I am now. Prior to that, I was going hell for leather, boots and all, high input farmer, believing absolutely that if I got the agronomy right, spent enough money, profit would ensue through high yield. And I probably think now that I almost think the opposite to that. You can make a very good profit with very low inputs. You can manage for the landscape to improve, and have a good business as well as a good life. Yep.
Neighbouring farmers or poverty managers in your area trying to emulate your model of farm management? Are they sort of seeing the benefits from it and coming to you for advice on how they can sort of improve the health of their properties as well? Could that probably be in a similar sort of landscape, similar sorts of problems as what you showed in your 1983 photo? I mean, can you comment on that?
Yes. This is once again an example of what I was saying before about how we are as people. There's very few people in my local area who've actually asked me about what we're doing. But I've been asked to speak all over Australia about what I'm doing. And that's not at all surprising because, if whatever you're doing currently is what to you makes sense of the world. So to admit to yourself that there's maybe a better way of doing it or a different way of doing it, that's a big thing for everybody to admit that. So human beings, I think, have the most infinite capacity to justify whatever it is that they're doing because they want to believe that they're good folk. Everyone wants to believe they're a good guy. And so it doesn't really surprise me that locally people don't ask me much about what we're doing. And I don't try and shove it down anyone's throat either because I think that's a real turn off. But if anyone wants to talk about it, I'm very happy to. So there's quite a number of people who are managing like us in our local area. There's about 10,000 farmers in Australia that have had this sort of training. And there's a wide-ranging degree of practice after people do these sorts of courses. And some people go in boots and all right at the start. Some people take a long time to implement some of this stuff. I think the hardest thing for people to do is to fundamentally change. We all struggle with it. We struggle with it as a society. So, but generally for most people, the change, a lot of people come to holistic management because they're in a crisis. So tension creates the desire for change. You see that all the time. We've known about climate change. We know that our soils are not in great shape. We know lots of things. But unless our lives are threatened or we're going out of business or we're in pain or going to be in pain, we're pretty happy with the status quo. We're not that interested in change. Unless there's a crisis, then we can change like mad.
Question over there.
Thanks. That was the essence of the question I was going to ask, but I'd like to extend that to Michele and David. How do you cope with transferring that information to get more people to change their ways?
Is this for me?
Thanks for your question, Roger. Land management practice change isn't a fast process, and so those people who are familiar with the soil acidification issue will know that there's been really big efforts made by scientists and extension people over a very long number of years. John will probably correct me here, but it will be 25 or 30 years where farmers have been encouraged to lime their soils, and it still looks like a significant proportion of them aren't liming their soils to the extent that's necessary. Part of the issue is information failure. People don't have the information that they need to make the decisions, but that's not all of it. I think something that David said rings true for me, and it applies to governments as well as individuals and probably other sorts of organisations too, is that it's often quite difficult to get change unless there's something fairly precipitous that happens. Lots and lots of us who've worked in the water area in the past, for example, knew that there were very serious problems in relation to water, including in the Murray-Darling Basin, long, long before it got on the political agenda. But it was really the last drought and the potential for communities to run out of water that really happened before there were some major decisions made that we absolutely have to act. And I think that that's probably true of a range of things that we can think about. So the kinds of things that we've been supporting through Caring for Our Country, which I think we need a bit more work on to see how they are going, activities like field days and having things going on, field days and demonstration sites at the community level so people can see that it's working in their community, on their soil types, in their farming systems. And I think that's probably reasonably successful. I'm sure it's not all the answer, and I'd be very pleased to hear later on when we have a glass of wine what sorts of things other people think can be done.
John Angus, did you want to comment? Thank you. Yes.
I suppose one of the largest growing sectors of Australian agriculture, and possibly Papua New Guinea, is the corporate sector. And you're finding in southeastern Australia mixed farms being sold to companies headquartered in Minnesota or Zurich. They tear down the fences, they sell the livestock, and they crop it from fence to fence. Spray from the air, have low-cost production. The total opposite of the systems that David and Michele were talking about, and possibly Mike as well, because I suspect that corporate farming is growing in the Southwest Pacific as well. I don't know whether the corporate farms are engaged in caring for our country, for example, but how do we engage with this new and growing sector of the industry?
Happy to come in there. Just on John's comment about corporate farms, in PNG it's not that big. The main corporate farmers are all palm producers. New Britain palm oil is now listed on the London Stock Exchange, which means they have to keep growing. They're actually a very responsible company. And despite the bad publicity here about oil palm, it's a very responsible industry, certainly in Papua New Guinea and Solomons. Different in Malaysia and Indonesia. But in PNG, they're essentially, what they're doing, they're selling to the European market, they're selling at a higher value. So when the palm oil gets to, I think it's Southampton, They've actually got their own depots that goes in. It's not mixed up with palm oil that's coming in from Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, which is aimed at the cheaper markets, China and India, etc. They're going for the higher value European market. They follow something called ISO 14001, I think it's called. So they, what little chemicals they do use, and they don't use that much anymore, it never goes into the ocean, and they don't drain swamps anymore. So they're actually quite responsible. They bring a lot of, much of the better aspects of corporate life. So, for example, when you go to the All Palm Research Association, half the people there are females and half are males. There's a lot more women involved. There's a lot more family-friendly business. And it's brought by the international corporate sector is actually raising the bar. But coming back to the question before, if I could, Richard, about how do you change things, you have to understand the society in which you're working. For example, we know very well how to, where I work in the highlands of New Guinea, how to raise the yield of coffee. The village yields is 800 kilos per hectare on average. It is not difficult to do a few things, a bit of pruning, manage a shade, manage a pruning, manage a fencing, to double that and to get 1,600 kilos of coffee like the plantations do. In doubling your yield, you quadruple your labour inputs. So from a Western point of view, what matters is how many dollars you get per hectare. From a Papua New Guinea villager point of view, what matters is how many dollars or kina you get per person day. It is not per hectare or per anything else. It's per person day. If your rate of labour goes up faster than your returns, you won't do it. So all the extension ever done on promoting the yield of coffee, oil palm and many other factors, it's failed. It's failed consistently. It's failed for decades because it increases the rate of labour. So you have to understand that that really fundamental thing. We're involved at the moment on the LNG project, and it's been a bit of a revelation to me working with a whole lot of ladies, six ladies in my team actually, who work with food processing, because I'm sort of an agricultural background and we've got animal people, but I hadn't really seen how important food processing was. So this is making biscuits, making cakes, all sorts of things, baked chicken, bread, extracting oil from a plant called Marita, it's a pandanus species, but you have really quick success. We're mostly working with ladies, but sometimes men as well. But a couple of weeks ago, my colleagues, with some help from me, finished a course on a Friday, and by Tuesday morning, two of the ladies had been making donuts. They went up to the market, but they sold out before they even got to the market. And I came back to them and said, okay, what's the message there? Double the amount of flour. Next week, double it again, you know, until you reach saturation. But don't eat them yourself, because they're not very good food, actually. So you can get very quick returns there. So that's how we started off with baking. But I was at a workshop about a year ago, and a colleague of mine, he's a professor, a retired professor from UQ, and he made the point that the generation of Papua New Guinea now, particularly the young mothers and not so young mothers, they don't know about nutrition and hygiene. And it's true. So in the 70s and 80s, you'd be out in the middle of nowhere. You'd be, you know, 2 days' walk from a road, and some lady you talk about green, yellow, white. That's rital. Three food groups, these basic messages. The mothers today say, look at the white people. They're tall. They live for us. They live longer than us. They have grey beards. We're all dead before we're 55. Their food's superior to ours. Well, it's actually not. A little bit of protein, a little bit of oil in your diet is good, but much of the food that goes through the stores, Coca-Cola and all the things full of sugar, is actually detrimental, and it raises the level of diabetes, etc. So a lot of things we're doing is saying it's not just because white people eat doesn't make it good. It's actually a mixture of traditional food and a little bit of high protein, chicken and canned meat, etc. What I've been doing myself is telling personal stories. You know, but my end, I'm fluent in Pidgin. I speak in Pidgin, but one of my colleagues, I translate into local languages. When my ancestors left Europe, when my grandmother's grandfather left Scotland in 1861 and came to Victoria, left his wife behind with four kids. By the time she'd turned up there in 63, 2 years later, two kids were buried. When I was a kid growing up in the 1950s, there was a handkerchief with a bit of soil from their graves. So I tell stories from my life and make the point that white people have a history that's not that different from you. It's changed, and this case has changed because of germ theory, understanding about cleaning your hands after you change your kid's nappy and wipe their bum before you cook food and all that sort of thing. And in fact, sometimes I tell the story why in Europe it goes right back to why the Europeans, the Mediterraneans, had wine and had glass with the wine that led to discovering the microscope and germ theory, etc. So I tell stories like that that people relate to from my own family history. In this case, I speak in one language, but then that's translated into another language. And the ladies that we're mostly women we work with, particularly the younger women, because they are more flexible. But we discover that those personal stories, in the society I work in at least, that they do work well. but maybe it's not so different in this society.
Yeah, I just wanted to go back to that question of change and how to get uptake of things. This is a bit of a plug, really, but I'm on the board of a thing called Outcomes Australia. They've got a project called Soils for Life, and they're in the process of quantifying 20 farms across Australia that are doing similar sorts of things to what we're trying to do, putting some numbers around that from a social business and landscape perspective, and then promoting that and trying to get people to go and visit those farms to try and accelerate change. Now, that process has been going on. I'm on the board of one of the catchment authorities in New South Wales, and we've been trying to do that sort of stuff for quite a while as well, but this has got a fair bit of grunt behind it, in that it's headed up by Mike Jeffries, former Governor-General, who's a terrific fellow, and he really believes in this stuff, and he's very good at opening doors and getting people to listen at a high level. So that's one thing that's going on, but it's, I think, a big ask, but when you listen to Mike Jeffries talk about something that seems difficult seems possible. And to just onto the lime thing, the lime thing was one of the things that got me worried about what we were doing when we were high input farmers. We were putting on 2.5 tonnes of lime to the hectare so we could grow canola. And we were quite good at growing canola, or it grew quite well on our paddocks. In high input cropping, in 8 years, you're back to the pH that you needed to apply 2.5 tonnes of lime. So I said to myself, well, if I'm removing this much product and getting back to square one in 8 years, that means I'm going to apply 2.5 tonnes of lime 12 times in 100 years, and it's only calcium carbonate. So what are the other things that are going to be affected or become available or cause problems by that activity? And we did do a reasonable amount of liming. Now we don't seem to do anything except watch grass grow.
Question down here, and then gentleman
back. This question's aimed at Mike. It seems like some really good initiatives are going on with the remote indigenous communities in PNG regarding sanitation and things like that. And of course, a lot of your speech was focused on the fact that the bulk of income for the bulk of remote people is based on agriculture. But then again, a large percentage of the export GDP comes from mining. So what happens when these two industries come into conflict? For example, what's happening at the moment in the Western Province, specifically the Ok-Tedi people and their lands on which they can no longer produce the agriculture which supports them?
Yeah, sure. What happened in the Western Province, a vast amount of overburden goes down the Ok River and down the Flow River. The sums are mind-boggling. I've heard figures of 200,000 tonnes per day. I mean, it's staggering to believe, but it's extraordinary. And it's destroyed a lot of land. It will destroy it for a couple of hundred years. One reason that, like 200 years, BHP got out of there, and one reason they could see acid rock coming, and that's what they're hitting now. They've gone down with that mine further and further down. The owners, which is a Canadian minority interest, and well, the PNG Sustainable Fund actually has about 50%, and then the PNG government has 30%. But the owners wanted to keep on going. They've hit the acid rock, and now they're putting out a lot of acid, and it really is even worse environmentally. Those people weren't agriculturalists as such. They had sago, but they've lost their sago resources. So that's a physical outcome. More broadly, what you see with the resource extraction, whether it's the logging, whether it's the gas, the oil, or the mining, it's the social and environmental damage is much greater than the physical stuff. Now, Ok-Tedi is a fairly spectacular case, and that's why BHP got out of it. But it's the social and the economic damage is much greater. So for a start, the Papua New Guinea currency has risen 30%. So this is April 10 to April 12. In 24 months, it's risen by 30% against the US dollar. And that's really bad for both domestic food production and export production. So cashew, which is a new crop, which is, I think, my view, pretty marginal, but it's just not economical as the kina rises in value, because you're paying people in kina, but your money's coming in US dollars. So rising currency is one issue, but also one reason that that imports of food are fairly static in Papua New Guinea is with a weak currency. So it's really expensive. So a lady goes to the market and she gets 10 kina worth of, you know, sells 10 kina worth of food, buys a Coca-Cola for the kids or something. She's got 6-7 kina left. That's only enough to buy 1 kilogram of Asian or now, again, Australian rice, which is only enough for the family for one night anyway. So really you don't buy that much rice, that much flour-based food or even... So for example, your protein foods, so between, say, 93 and 03, the consumption of meat went from 13 kilograms per person down to 5. Now, 13 is very low by our standards. That's per annum, by the way, 13 kilos to 5. And that's just when the currency went down. And the same with the sugar consumption's gone from 8 kilos down to about 5.5, again, with a weak currency. So as the currency gets stronger, it's bad for agriculture. But also you get these vast amounts of money pouring in. The money goes to the men. Very little goes to the ladies, virtually none. When you get vast amount of money, like 100,000 kina, 50,000 Australian, it goes to the men, it goes on alcohol, it goes on young women, it goes on travel, it goes on hotels. It doesn't go to the family. When I first went to the island of near Britain over 40 years ago, the north coast of that island was a pretty miserable place. They only exported labourers. You go back now, because of the oil palm and all the food and everything they need, the betel nut, it's a prosperous place. It's socially progressive. The roads are well done because you need it to move the palm oil, etc. That's all agriculture. The death rates come right down, your maternal death rate, your infant, your child death rate, your literacy rates have gone up. So all the social parameters are going in the right direction. That's all oil palm on the north coast. If you go to the south coast of that same island, which is too wet for oil palm, the rain falls between 4,000 and 7,000 a year, far too wet, there's no oil palm. That coast produced... It was the second most important source of tropical logs in the world after Sarawak in the 90s. Sarawak number one and New Britain number two, but there's nothing to show for it. Just the Malaysian loggers came in, they grabbed the logs, they moved on. A lot of money fell out of helicopters, but it was consumed. Travel, young woman, alcohol, nothing left. And the kids don't go to school, the schools aren't better, the aid posts, etc. So just that one island alone, the north coast with modern agriculture, in this case mostly oil palm, the south coast with just raping the forest, nothing to show for it. So that's what we see with the extractive industries, the quick money, whether it's copper, gold, oil or gas. The gas project that I'm on now, the difference is the scale of it. It is so vast. It is so huge. I'm one of 18,000 workers. We people are being paid. They earn as much in 2 weeks as... You know, we recruited people from a World Vision project I was on. I'm working with young Papua New Guineans in their 30s. They get paid every 2 weeks what they were paid a year ago in 1 year with World Vision. So it caused all sorts of distortion. Agriculture is slow. It's hard work. Mum and dad do it. Grandma, everyone does it. Because you work hard, the blokes might dissipate some of the money on grog, but it's really hard work. So you're more likely to put your kids to school and you get that social mobility. So sorry if it's a bit long-winded, but... That's the contrast I keep making, why I keep making a case for agriculture as distinct from this quick money, which really doesn't help people.
Okay. Probably the final question.
So I've got a question about the connection between water management and farm management. There's lots of ways I could ask this question, but I think and this is one probably for Michele mainly, but also David may want to comment. In the Northern Basin, where I'm familiar, you know, there are, if you're thinking about the catchment scale and landscape management, there are a lot of water diversion structures because people are really encouraged to harvest water and keep it on their farm to drought-proof themselves and to supply water. And it strikes me that that probably doesn't do a whole lot of good for soil management at the catchment scale, although it may be good for other reasons, and I'm wondering how you do try to have a policy that will hold, you know, will allow the rain to fall on soil and be held in soils in a kind of more natural way, and to perhaps have a better storage regime, which might not be so many diversions and farm dams and using more kind of natural underground storage.
I think that's probably a pretty difficult question to answer. In terms of trying to improve soil water storage capacity, I think that building carbon has a significant role there. Exactly how much you can do is obviously very constrained by climate and soil type, I think it's a bit hard to say very much about on-farm storage. It obviously depends on where you are and how big those storages are, because some of the very big storages in the northern parts of the Murray-Darling Basin, very large ring tanks and so on, obviously change the flow patterns for some of those intermittent streams in a very major way, and of course have big impact on the productivity of some of those floodplain areas for grazing people. But it's a bit hard to give an answer without knowing, you know, what something about the more specific localities.
I think the figure for the amount of water that gets into storages, I'm not sure whether that includes farm dams, but out of every 100 drops of rain that falls, there's supposedly only 2 that gets into a storage. Most of the rain that falls on the landscape, and its fate after it hits the landscape is very much determined by the vegetation that's there, and B, the management that's been applied to the vegetation, which has a profound influence on the amount of organic matter that's actually in the soil. We've dug up some plants a few years ago and tried to get a bit of a handle on how much organic matter we were, our management was adding to soil compared to conventional management during the drought. And the figure we came up with was that because of the size of the root structures under the plants that we had compared to the identical species in conventionally managed country right next door, was that we were, the plants under our management were actually 13 times as much root mass. Now that's a really big difference, and it came at absolutely no cost. So that has a profound effect upon the fate of water that hits the ground, and it's a really big benefit to the farm where it falls, but it's also, if everyone manages to increase organic carbon and organic matter, both related obviously, in their soils, it's not only a benefit to individual farms, but you'll have much more sustained flows in rivers, so we won't have these big flood events. We'll still have floods, obviously, but they may not be as intense as they are at times.
Okay, so no further questions. It just remains for me to thank the members of the panel. Thank you very much, Michelle, for your very good explanation of the work that's going on at government level. Mike, for your extensive knowledge of work in the Asian Pacific region. David, for how we implement a lot of these practices at the farm level and your success. And Jonah, just some of the issues about how you get yourself into your first job. Thank you all, and thanks to the audience for your questions. I'll hand back to Steve Dovers now to invite you to supper.
I'd repeat my thanks to all our panellists, and also thanks to Richard for his contribution, both in organising and things. And thank you all for coming, and if you wish to join us for something to eat and drink, I hope you do, best way is straight down that way, down the steps, to the new seminar room in the Frank Fenner building. If you do happen to not join us, could you leave your tag so we can recycle? We do things like that here. Thanks very much for coming, and if we could show our appreciation to our panellists.